Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Midrack, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to, I guess, what is best described as the Midsummer Block Party here on Midrats. We have no guests, no fit topics. We're going to do something kind of as an opportunity for some of our regular listeners and the readers of our blogs who might want to come in and call in, because we shifted our format after the first 10 shows or so, where we do the C-SPAN program without the callers, where we just do individual conversations with our guests, with the rare exception. And I know most people here get a little bit of gun-shy, but I want to encourage everybody to call in if you so desire. One person or 100 persons makes no difference. If you could call in, our number is 347-308-8397. Of course, if you're listening to us online, which almost all of you are, that's right up there on the show page. You'll see the number 347-308-8397. You can pick the topic, you can pick the observation, whether it's a question for Eagle One or myself. And as good Southerners here in the midsummer, we both reacted in our usual manner. I spent some time on my little boat, and now I'm sitting here with a big, tall glass of iced tea. And Eagle One, my co-host, has, in the finest traditions of Southern gentlemen, has retreated to his fortress of solitude that's a little more higher elevation and a little bit cooler. Eagle One, how are we doing this afternoon?
I'm cool and comfortable up here in the mountains.
Outstanding. And it may just be the two of us having a conversation today, because it looks like most of our listeners are being a little bit shy on the phones. So all of our lines are open. Don't be shy about calling in, because we just might talk about things you'll find uncomfortable. But while we're waiting for anybody to call in, if you so wish, Eagle One, before we unfroze here and our pre-show conversation, so to speak, we were talking about something that I thought I'd bring up, because I know I got a few emails from my listeners, probably over a half dozen of them, going, why haven't you talked about this? Why haven't you talked about this? And before I mention the topic, I'll give my reason why. Mostly out of disgust, because it ceased to be a story that I really had any interest in, because I was... The reason that I would bring it up was obvious to everybody involved, and that happened to do with the what I consider a very sad spectacle of the Sailor of the Year Awards. First of all, as anybody who's read my blog any length of time knows, I have always been, from the beginning, it's horrible I have to put out this disclaimer, but yeah, that's okay. I have always been a supporter of women in the military and serving in everywhere they can, given objective criteria, been the norm for my career. I know other people have different opinions, and good people can disagree on it. But the Sailor of the Year, all four were female, and that really just set me back, and here's why. In theory and in practice, we are a Navy at war. And in a year that has seen more casualties than any other in Afghanistan, and a much higher presence by the Navy in Afghanistan, for the Sailor of the Year, you're telling me that there are no spec warfare people on there? There were no corpsmen on there? Or any other communities that are predominantly male? I mean, we have lots of women in the service, but as a percentage, it's rather small. And I just thought it was, and these were all great sailors, but we have lots of great sailors out there. I would just the statistical odds of that happening, especially in the Navy of War. It just left me cold, so I never blogged on it. What do you think, Eagle One?
Yeah, the odds are slim, and it is annoying. I mean, I don't know what these sailors did. Maybe they're outstanding in many ways, but I think the special operations people, the fast attack submariners, the CBs, I mean, the people that we discussed before we went live on air, would all seem to have candidates who, during a wartime situation, would come to the fore. And it's very surprising to see how it managed not to happen.
Yeah, it's. I wish them all well, and it was all beautiful and stuff, but the whole thing just left me cold. I didn't even want to cover it. You know, Sailor of the Year, whatever. It's just become another parade of tokens. I'm sorry to say.
You still there?
Ooh, am I still here?
I got you now.
Okay. I had to reset circuit breakers. Everything's made by Raytheon now. This.
Let's see, we got one question from Poland about the U.S. diminishing naval presence in the Pacific while other countries are building theirs up, Japan, Australia, and while China, of course, is building.
Yeah, I think it's all in numbers, and I think the challenge is going to get even worse. I guess, you know, one thing we could talk about here would be Admiral Harvey's comment that you know, we can fix the surface force in 2 years. We have trouble changing a unit patch in 2 years. I didn't care much for that because I think it's a false comfort to people. Because the big challenge is the fact that best case scenario with the budgetary pressures is we're going to have a steady state in real dollars shipbuilding budget. It's actually going to decline. And I also think that with the ships that we have in the pipeline that are so expensive, and this year, you know, we've thrown to the side 7 ships. We're not building that many. You're going to see fewer and fewer ships to go meet that presence over in Westpac. What are your thoughts, Eagle One? And then we'll take our first caller.
Yeah, I think we're fighting a numbers war, and I don't think we really understand something. I mean, the numbers just don't work. That we can't continue to build the big ships and have the presence we need. But I don't think that's really done, you know, hasn't really come home yet. So it's going to be an interesting challenge in the future. And the effect of that, if we're going to extend deployments on ships, there's so many other issues that causes. You know, if you extend the deployments of a surface ship and you're going to rotate crews, what's that do? If the ship has embarked helicopters, how do you get the squadrons to support those? What are you going to do with that? With those problems down the line, and do you have enough aircraft to support extended deployments like that? I think we see a lot of interesting challenges coming up in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Like most hard challenges, you need some direct conversations, and I don't think you're going to fix anything in 2 years. And we're going to take our first caller this afternoon, area code 904. Welcome to Midrex.
Hope you can understand me. This is Byron.
That combination of Cajun and North Florida accent, I think we can translate pretty well for you. How are things over?
It was real hot. Now it's started to cool off a little bit. I think I sent an email a while back about, I noticed it almost directly after Harvey made his comment about, on his blog about, we're letting our ships go to rot. We need to take better care of them. That an SRA was let out that had more preservation packages on it than I've ever seen before on any ship at Mayport. Over 20 of them, which is pretty much unheard of. Usually you get an auxiliary space, a main space, a pot tank. This one has 22 preservation items. That's just unheard of. Nobody does that. And
you know,
a lot of these spaces I know, like the those big boxy intake uptake spaces, the deck in there is real thin, and because of welding, the way it buckles material from heat contraction, it holds a lot of water. They tend to get holes in them. And it's only going to get worse. Now, I love the Burks. They're great ships. But like any ship, it's always going to have a flaw here and there. That's theirs. And they've gone too long without a preservation on them. Well, now they're starting to catch up to them.
Now, is that preservation problem? Is that a fact that they don't have the maintenance cycle down right? They don't have the funding right? Or a byproduct of not having enough ship?
Both. All of it. Number one, the crew doesn't do it anymore. Number two, they don't fund enough to get enough preservation items in there. The FFGs are so old, they almost have to have preservation items in the machinery spaces every time. I wish I could tell you how many inserts we put in machinery spaces, because it's always got hard to get two spots. You just can't get behind all these pipes. You know, nobody wants to deal with them, and certainly nobody wants to look at them. And guess where we get the holes at?
What's the reaction you get from ship's company?
Oh, we're here to help you. We're glad you guys are aboard to fix it for us. What would you think? I mean, they can't. I was on an FFG not too long ago. They had a brand new TIG welding machine. We're talking $3,000 worth. I said, cool, you guys get to play some TIG welding now. The first class HT said, nah, I wish. They told us we're not allowed to use it. Well, why did you buy it? Well, we had our budget, so we went ahead and bought this. Makes sense, don't it?
Eagle One.
Well, I mean, the plan was, as I understand it, when I was looking back at the issue of the, you know, the minimal manning ships, was that they were supposed to stand up, I guess what used to be the equivalent of SIMAs and all kinds of shore-based assets to help these ships out on their maintenance. But I gather that didn't happen, Byron. Is that right?
Well, back when they started all that, there was a saying on the waterfront that SIMA was our best friend. SIMA made more work than they got completed. Just to give you a case in point, you all know that when you get a big pipe, a column, a support vertical support structure in a wide open space, that if you have to put hot work on it with a burner or welding, you have to drill it out and sniff it with an explosive meter because it's a confined space and can contain, and generally will, especially if it's contained for a long while, make explosive gases. I caught SIMA getting ready to weld on one night on the old Yosemite, and I told him, look, do me a favor. Hold your hot work for 15, 20 minutes so I can make sure all us contractors get the hell off the ship before you blow the bottom out of it, because that's what you're fixing to do. That got SIMA kicked off the boat that night.
That's one of the influence people. Eagle, let me bounce and a question to you. When you're on the go,
you're breaking up there, so.
I'm sorry. When you were on the gun line off Vietnam, how old was the ship that you were on?
Well, it was a Gehring class destroyer, Framed. So 29, 30 years old.
Do you remember at that point what type of corrosion issues you had?
Well, you know, there was a point with the gearings where there was probably more Bondo in the hull than there was hull. You had to be careful not to chip the paint too hard because you could spring a leak. But then, you know, that ship, we retired it after in-serve told us we were no longer fit to sail, and the South Koreans, I think, sailed it for another 10 years.
It's all relative. And, hey, Byron, we got another caller on the line. Did you have one more point before we switched over?
Yeah, I think Lee needs to call in. He's got something to tell you about the LCS, that wonderful gift that keeps on giving. You'll have a fine day.
Okay, and hey, if we get another dead spot, Byron, feel free to call back in.
All right, we'll do.
Okay, I'm going to bet $10 that we got Lee on the line.
Yes, you do.
Well, it's good to see that we have two of the greatest Area Code 904 Type B personalities on Midrats. this afternoon. What good words do you have for us?
Well, I just saw the PAC fleet press release on how wonderful the LCS-1 did during RIMPAC, and I practically gagged. It was out there doing ocean escort duties, newsflash, and did a wonderful job at DBSS and its helo filed some hellfires at the sinking ship. And I thought to myself, what the hell does this have to do with the littoral duties? Am I missing something here, or has the LCS already switched over to being ocean escort? Nice littoral ship.
Lee, come on. You're not being informational enough. We all know that ocean escort is a radical new mission that critical technology was needed to bring to the Navy. You just old fart. You're just not thinking transformational enough.
I tell you, as you know, we've been kicking this around with Bill, the high-performance marine vessels architect of long standing here, and we decided that the LCS-1 was an absolutely failed design from a naval architecture standpoint about 9 months ago. We figured that out, and everybody's betting on it winning the down select, for all the wrong reasons.
Let me bounce this question off of you, because I think you have a better chance of explaining it than I do. I've read a fair bit in open source recently that am I better now?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you using an old Navy mic or something there, Sal?
I need to get something else.
I'd read your 5x.
There we go. When you actually put a loadout on LCS-1 and enough fuel to go a couple of kilometers, that she can't even get up on plane, which is an important part of that hull design. Are you familiar with that issue? And
absolutely.
If so,
that's precisely the reason why. That's the precisely the reason why Bill told higher ups that it is quote in naval architecture terms. I ain't a naval architect. I'm a deckie. Naval architecture terms, the LCS-1 is a, quote, failed design. It has already gotten so heavy that it has fallen off its hydrostatic lines and can never get back up on them. It's gone. It's failed now. When you start loading her up with all the other stuff they're going to put on board, the mission modules and all this other kind of stuff, and a full load of fuel, it just makes the situation worse. It becomes then a fully displacement hull vessel and not a hydrodynamically disported vessel. It's failed now.
Eagle One.
Among the other issues, we just have to hook an oiler to this thing if it's going to do the speed, any kind of speed at all. I understand even if they don't go to speed, they're going to run dry. So it's we probably ought to be looking at that problem too.
Well, having been around ship acquisition for a while and seeing how NAVSEA fiddles and farts around with the acquisition plans, and I'm talking about the specific document, AP, the AP has assumed an operational tempo that is at least a year and a half to 2 years old and out of date already. So the entering arguments to the evaluation of which ship is better is already skewed. We've already shot ourselves in the foot by not revising out tempo. Revising out tempo required more go back and do it again paperwork.
I think when this whole program is looked back at, that it's going to be, and I think we've talked about this before, it's a classic example of why you do not assume so much risk in a platform. You have technology risk, where we've seen the fact that the NLOS, the non-line-of-sight missile, the Army has gotten rid of it, so we still don't have the answer how we're going to rescue that. You have the technology risk of the various mission modules that just are not ready for prime time. And some of them are almost laughable, specifically the ASW module. If they really think that's going to do open ocean escort, they need to go up to the Northern Pacific some winter time. And you also have just design risk, trying to do too much at one place. I guess the follow-on question to that is, if LCS-1 is just she's too fat to ski. Can LCS2, is that platform flexible enough that we can fix it and make it useful, or is it just too early to know at this point?
LCS2, according to my sources, is perfectly fine and has the space and weight margins to perform additional missions. The LCS2 is performing exactly as they programmed it to. And oh, by the way, the folks down in Austell and their counterparts have enough extra in it to float her up some. It is a modern trimaran design based on existing vessels that have proven themselves, as opposed to the LCS-1, which was a majorly the major thing about the LCS-1 was they took an established mega yacht, high speed mega yacht hull, and said, oh, what a change.
Did I just lose audio?
I hear you.
I did it. That killed it right there. They changed. They went up to a steel hull. That killed it right there.
Okay, we lost Eagle One. I was about to hand it over to him, but he's calling from the deep forest. Let me tee up a real softball for you, Lee. I think this might help your blood pressure. You've always been a real strong advocate of better utilizing the MSC concept and manning concept on board other ships. If you were given an opportunity to take one of your ideas and do a fleet experiment on it on an 18-month period on one of our ships, what would it be and what would you be trying to demonstrate by it?
The main one that I have recently advocated is going over to the MSC system where there are dedicated engineering officers. The engineering, being a ship's engineer in and of itself is a career path. MSC has deck department led by the master and engineering department run by the chief engineer. They both get to the captain level, in the GS system, and they're equally regarded. And I think we need to get back to that. By the way, that has already been tested, and rather successfully. But the Navy killed the report.
Well, that's what the Royal Navy does.
Yeah, and so does the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. I mean, the world does it. Why doesn't the United States Navy do it? And I'm not talking EDOs here. I'm talking line officers who are engineers.
Yeah, I think one of the lamest reasons I've heard from people is like, well, you can't have three commanders on a ship, you know, if you're going to have a weapons path, an engineering path, and a deck path. I'm like, sure you can. A CO is a CO. Yeah, I've never really understood that. I haven't seen a successful argument besides the fact, well, that's the way we've always done it, and that's never an answer with me. I agree. It would be great because we all see it on major staffs where you have outstanding officers who there just wasn't a ship for them to command, and they're in a two-coded end billet, and they're brilliant engineers, master's degrees in engineering. And you just go, oh, for God's sake, can we get this guy away from answering email and typing out messages? And can we put him on a ship where he could help somebody? There's a lot of underused talent where in other navies that would be tapped into. Eagle One, I think we have you back if you wanted to pile in.
Yeah, I just, among other things, I think that the focus of what we're trying to do with our ship seems to be lost. I mean, I know that in World War II, nobody really anticipated the role of the carrier before World War II the way it has it worked out. But that being said, we really have to focus on creating ships to mission and not just creating ships and then trying to figure out if you can shoehorn it into any given mission.
Lee, you still there?
Yeah, let me be tangential for a second, okay?
Of course.
Eagles comment, but let me give you a historical example. I know plenty of MSC chief engineers who have served on the one or two or three classes of ships, four and five, six tours. These gents know the plant inside and out. They can walk aboard and in one day's time relieve the chief engineer that's going off, and they know exactly what's wrong with the system, with the engineering systems on board from a historical standpoint and from a going ahead standpoint. There is nothing wrong with having dedicated chief engineers, and then you get it or in the MS in the Navy parlance, you know, engineering officers of the line.
Yeah, I think if you scratched a deep, you might hear excuses that would raise your blood pressure, which would defeat what we just did, giving you a chance to get your fleet experiment going. It's a conversation I remembered having at the very beginning of LCS when I was stupid enough to ask the question, like, oh, wow. You know, we're talking 60 sailors on a ship, so we're going to have some lieutenant commander commands or lieutenant commands going on here. I was like, no, these are going to be commander commands. I was like, why? That's small. That's barely a detachment. They said, well, we need the commander commands so we can make more captains. So, I think the argument on the other side might be a little touchy.
Let me add one more point here. Saw the original LCS brief. The original LCS brief was a full spiral development of the designs. Those designs were supposed to have been developed over a 6-year period. Guess what didn't happen?
They didn't spiral design.
They didn't follow the spiral. They shortcut the spiral and decided to buy something quick and do the down select early.
Well, it's LCS. You know, I think I did a post a while back. It's the gift that keeps on giving, and that's what we're going to have. And I tell you what, Lee, let's let Eagle One throw a question your way, and then we'll say good afternoon, Eagle One. Eagle One, you there?
Eagle still there?
I've been bouncing it out of Skype. You guys go ahead without me for a minute.
Let me ask Eagle One this, since we're kind of along these lines about crewing and such. Why does the United States Navy forbid installed weapon systems on naval auxiliaries? That's a legal question as opposed to a physical question.
Yeah, it really has to do with how they're treated under the laws of war, and
RFA does it, but they're auxiliaries.
Yeah, I assume, and this is always a dangerous assumption, that there are contingency plans for scenarios in which that might be required. But in the meantime, it simplifies a lot of other operations for those vessels.
I was just talking to two Royal Navy's able-bodied seamen, sailors, off of the RFA Large Bay last Wednesday, and who manned the weapons on board that RFA vessel. The weapons included everything from several 30-millimeter cannons to Gatling guns on down to 50 calibers. They've been doing that for decades.
Yeah, the traditional route that we've gone to over the last 2 years is simply to put a security, under certain situations, put armed security teams on the ships. And there are other reasons for not arming those under normal peacetime conditions, and I think that's simply why it's not done right now.
I see no reason why the Navy cannot reinstitute the Naval Armed Guards.
What's the threat is the question, and if they can avoid putting sailors handling the weapons on those ships, then they can theoretically use those sailors in some other location, and it's really a manpower question among other things.
Hit me offline, and I'll send you my my pitch on Naval Armed Guards.
Okay, happy to look at it.
And Lee, thanks a lot for calling
drop
in. We got
here.
Another.
I'll drop off here.
Okay. We've got another caller on the line, and if we get some dead air later on, I'll put out the call, and we'll put you in strategic reserve there with Byron, and have a great Navy day. And we're going to go ahead and bring up one of our buddies from Skype. So, next caller coming in off of Skype, welcome to Midrats. Hello. Oh, wait. Switchboard problems. Skype. How you doing?
Hey, Sal. It's Claude Barraby.
Claude, hey, welcome back to MidRap. Thanks for calling in. What's the
thanks?
What's the big topic up there in the glorious suburbs of Washington, D.C. and Annapolis?
Actually, I think the bigger topics are the ones that were just being discussed by a couple of the callers. And, you know, as I was reading, as checking out the Washington Post this morning, and Stephen Hadley and William Perry had an op-ed. It was called A Defense Plan for the 21st Century. And looking through my new issue of Proceedings, I just thought, since you had an open line, I'd talk about a little bit of perspective on these issues, if you have a few minutes.
Absolutely. Fire away.
When you think about it, some would argue that we're in a unique period, our challenges and debates unknown. So where exactly are we right now? We're experiencing, as a nation, economic crisis with rising unemployment and failing banks. It's an era of a possibly threatening power, as comparatively minor maritime incidents could expand into wider conflicts if not contained, managed, or otherwise resolved. There's a long war against unconventional forces and what one newspaper has described as the inherent geographical constraints to our forces. Some in the U.S. are criticizing the cost of blood and treasure. It's a war criticized by the overseas media. The Times of London, for example, seem to revel in the fact that the enemy's numbers don't seem to diminish despite the great power of the United States. And another foreign paper talks about the ingenuity of the indigenous enemy warfighters and the growing apprehensiveness of the American public. The war's generated renewed interest in riverine warfare, as well as Navy's efforts to try new technologies of ships, so trying to deal with budget challenges to pay for a land war. But then you think about the maritime security challenges. Our ships are encountering illicit human trafficking off of Africa. Our Navy faces pirates, which threaten legitimate commerce on the far side of the world. If you look at the debates within the Navy and the halls of Congress, they focus on force structure and the merits of large ships. As some in Congress suggest, the expensive and growing costs might be better spent on domestic programs. One thing after another, they talk about operating in the littorals. And the thing is, we're not in a unique period. What I've just described is actually happened about 170 years ago during the Jacksonian era, the 1830s. We had a long land war with the Second Seminole War from 1835 to 42. Which cost about 15% in casualties, and in regarding the budget, the cost of the war actually exceeded the federal budget. And, of course, this was all in the middle of the economic panic of 1836 and 37, where banks were failing. The Navy established a riverine squadron in what I would call that most desolate and dangerous of enemy territories, Florida, which you're familiar with, Sal, I think. At the same time, we were fighting pirates in the Caribbean, off Greece and elsewhere. We had an anti-slavery squadron patrolling off Africa. But what I think is most noteworthy with regard to the previous two callers, there was at least one proposal for a radically new ship. It was a tri-hulled ship using a new technology of steam. The House Committee on Naval Affairs promoted its, quote, simplicity, mobility, crew safety, the small force required to man it, its certainty of operation, and its cheapness. And that was a steam-powered ram ship, paddle-wheel ram ship, pretty innovative design. So I think when we're looking at these, I think the important thing is how do we overcome these challenges that we've actually faced before. I know you guys have talked before on the show about what's going to happen 10 years out with as the budgets increase. I think we're looking at about, what, an $18 to $20 trillion dollar deficit in the next decade, and how that's going to affect not only readiness but recapitalization. But there's a whole slew of issues that we're looking at, and I just wanted to point out we've been there before and we got through it once before. I just don't know how we're going to get through it this time.
And I think that you bring up a point that is so important, not just for the Navy, for the nation in general, but specifically the Navy. And that's one of the big issues I've had with the transformationalist, is they'll come at you with big eyes about war is new, everything's new, and because it's new and unknown, I have the secret formula answer. And that's just not an accurate statement. If everybody would take a deep breath and rewind a bat, you can see where these challenges have been seen before, and you can learn from those and hopefully as a result come up with a better solution. But there's no reason, you know, don't panic. Everything's fine. Just take a deep breath and let's look at the patterns and the lessons that have been learned before, and you're going to get some insight into challenges in front of us, though nobody can see into the future either. And you brought up in the very beginning where people can read about that. Could you repeat again, because I know there's some of the listeners who will go, hey, where can I find that? That sounds interesting. Where can they go to read about this?
Actually, I'm writing my dissertation on the subject, but so it's going to be 3 years before the whole thing comes out. But I've touched on it in a couple of articles in the June 2010, so just a couple months ago, issue of Naval History. There was an article I wrote regarding RAM ships, U.S. Navy RAM ships of the 20th century. But if they go back, I think it was the January of 2008 or 2009 issue of Proceedings. It was called the USS Pennsylvania Battling Budgets, Interest Groups, and Other Challenges, where we were building the ship of the line, Pennsylvania, in the 1830s, largely because of congressional parochialism, more than the use of this then-old technology. We were really building a white elephant at that point, one of the largest ships of the line. But she was being built in Philadelphia. And when you read the transcripts of the – or read the congressional record – of that era, you get a sense of understanding of why some members of Congress supported it. For example, the congressman who represented the Philadelphia Navy Shipyard at the time clearly supported investing money in this. So again, none of this is new. We keep coming back to this again and again, and I think your point is well taken that nothing in war is new.
Eagle One.
And arguably in politics.
Well, I'm also, you look at the history of the, as they brought those first steam warships on, you know, the unintended consequence was that we all now needed coaling stations around the world, and the race for space to put those was on, and that led to a lot of interesting consequences down the road, too.
No, I think you're right. And the thing is, even through that decade, the technology still had to evolve. I mean, you had the accident with the Princeton, for example, on the Potomac, which killed a couple of the members of the cabinet. Robert Field Stockton was in command of the ship at that time. So, you know, technology was new, untried, but they kept trying. And I think one of the things that got us out of that era, well, several of the things, were the creativity and the ability to adapt to new circumstances. And as I was reading through some of the early correspondence with the naval officers, you know, the initiatives and the creativity, oddly enough, weren't coming from Congress or the administration. They were actually coming from a lot of the mid-grade officers, the ones who were submitting patents to the Patent and Trademark Office for a lot of these designs. And they weren't just simply ship-wide designs. These were, you know, small components of ships. To change them, so they had a great deal of an impact during that era. The question is, will they today?
Here's a question for you, Claude. Kind of, if you could fold together your political and your Navy hat. One of our more senior admirals, a great thinker and an author as well, has one of the most difficult jobs around. I'm talking about Admiral Stavridis and his job as SACUR. And this month, what we're going to see that I know is on the front of his desk every morning, the Netherlands is leaving Afghanistan this month. 1,900 relatively caveat-free maneuver forces. They're going home and going home for good. We also have the Canadians are leaving next year. When you combine the Canadians and the Dutch, that's a combat brigade of relatively caveat-free forces and allied forces. Poland, their new president, recently announced that they want to go home next year, too, when they were actually ramping up forces through 2008-2009. Of course, the new prime minister, Cameron, has said 2014-2015, he wants everybody home. And, of course, we have President Obama announcement that he is slowly stepping back through intermediaries of us starting to go home in July of 2011. But we also have what you could argue is the best military team you could ask. Your in-theater operational commander is Petraeus. You've got Mattis over at U.S. CENTCOM. You have Gates as SecDef. And you also have a really smart thinker of Stavridis up at SAC. You're running NATO. If you could sit down in Stavridis' office for a 30 minutes over a cup of coffee, and he looked at you and like, Claude, help me with the political side. What are you seeing that he can try to do to, if you can't hold this alliance together, at least stop the run to the door? Because I see Germany as the next shoe to fall if Italy and Spain don't beat them to the punch.
Yeah, actually, did you mention the Brits too?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I was going back to that list. Well, that's a tough question, is to have a cup of coffee with Admiral Stavridis, because I'll tell you, I can't think of a time where we have some better minds up at the top with Admiral Stavridis. I think he may have the record with Naval Institute proceedings for being the only person to publish with them from 01 to his current rank, or he may have even written as a midshipman. You know, General Mattis is a voracious reader, and of course, General Petraeus. And, you know, I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't know what kind of advice I would give them, because they are the best-read team that I can think of. And I would actually have a cup, if I were able to have a cup of coffee with them, I'd ask questions of them, because they're in their positions for very good reasons, because they are very, very good.
Eagle One.
Well, going back to the history, and you're applying it, you know, we've been down this road before. The difference is that we've had a couple of wars, it seems, come along and kind of pull us out of our shipbuilding disasters before. Given where we are in the world and that we dominate the seas, and the biggest threat does seem to be in the littorals, what do you see, if anything, as the where we're going to go with the with our Navy, Claude?
I think
what a great clear question. I love those.
Yeah, from a budget standpoint, I think we're going to have to be very careful, because as eventually we wind down in Iraq, Afghanistan, we're going to be recapitalizing the assets that we've been using there in both places for now nearly a decade, and I think that will come at some risk to some Navy programs. I think there was some hope. I mentioned that op-ed earlier this morning by Mr. Perry and Mr. Hadley that suggested that we're going to need a bigger Navy to do the things that we need to do in the future. I also hesitate to say that we will be the dominant Navy in the future simply because of numbers, and I know that, you know, we've got to talk about capabilities too, but as they've always said, quantity has a quality all of its own. So I think that, you know, we're in a very precarious period coming up in the next decade or so with the Navy, and I think that the biggest part is going to have to be ways you mitigate some of the costs, especially with regard to long-term personnel costs. And I'm not saying reduce Navy manpower. I think there was something in the I want to say it was in the Navy Times a couple of weeks ago that said that the Navy, they were thinking of reducing the Navy personnel by another 9 to 25,000, which would bring us, I think, under 300 for the first time in a long time. So I would be very, very cautious about that in the next 10 years, as I'm sure you guys are. So, but anyway, listen, I'm sure you guys got a few callers lined up, so I don't want to take up all your time, but I appreciate the time to chat.
Hey, I'm not going to let you go that easily, because you scared our callers off the line. I wanted to throw a kind of a direct pitch at you. It's a kind of, in a month from now, we're going to have a returning couple of visitors to talk about the political implications of the next election. We're going to have Mackenzie Eglin on and Jim Robbins to come in and do the 6 weeks prior discussion that we had 6 months prior to the election. When it looks like there's a pretty good chance that the Republicans could take the House, and even the Senate is looking like it might be in play, there are going to be some significant players that are going to change in leadership. Do you see any type of change that may come from one party to another on emphasis in the House and Senate committees?
No. And I'll tell you why. And I'm saying this today. It's August 1st. I'm affiliated with no organization as of today. Tomorrow, I reaffiliate with another organization, so these opinions are my own. But I've been following politics all of my life. I think I worked on my first political campaign when I was 4 years old. It came from a long line of politicians going back a century. So I worked on a lot of campaigns. And so I follow the House and Senate races pretty closely. And I got to tell you, this is no 1994 for a couple of reasons. Number one, I don't think the RNC has as capable a leader as it did in 1994 with Haley Barbour, who was an extremely effective manager. And I don't think that the Republicans have as much vision right now as they did in 1994 when Gingrich presented something. I think the ideas that Paul Ryan has been espousing have been pretty interesting with regard to the budget. But the fact is, I think the Republicans will pick up seats in the House, and they'll get pretty close to taking it. They won't. In the Senate, I think people are being a little overly optimistic right now, and the Republicans will pick up a few seats, but I don't think those will change. What will change, however, is the ability for I'm trying to think of the name. It was the debt defense. It just came out about a month ago. It was Congressman Barney Franks and Cato's, and there was a whole bunch of folks who put out this plan for wiping out about $100 billion from the Department of Defense budget. And I think that will be mitigated by the increase in number of Republicans or potentially conservative Democrats who are able to hold, who don't want to risk themselves in another couple of years. But in my personal opinion, I've been on radio shows calling these for a few years now, I don't see the Republicans taking the House and the Senate this year unless things really change this fall.
Well, there you go. And I think that the point you brought up about the leadership issue is spot on. So it's one of those things you keep looking for the lead charging horse, and it's just not coming out strong. Eagle One, do you have one last question for Claude before we let him get back to his pedicure?
No. Whatever question I had just vanished with the image of that. Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you guys. And, I can't believe it. I thought I was actually calling into the Save Snooki from Jail Blog Talk Radio show, but it turned out to be you guys. So,
Well, whatever you were trying to do, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
You got to know who Snooki is. Come on, Eagle One. Put it in the next chapter of the book, okay? We'll see you guys. Take care.
And on now, it just came to mind that what would happen if Snooki and Lindsay Lohan were in a prison cell together. Linda Blair in Chained Heat, we could have chapter two of that. But Claude, thank you very much for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on Midrats again in the future.
You bet. Take care, guys.
Take care. And hey, we've got open lines. If anybody
Linda Blair and Chained Heat, oh my.
You have seen that, haven't you?
Yes, unfortunately.
Okay. Do you have it on Laserdisc, the big 14-inch one?
Yeah, I have a copy downloaded on my laptop.
There's a visual. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've got about 12 minutes left, so if we have some callers that want to call in, please do. It's open. I wanted to talk for a minute. Again, something else that Eagle One and I talked about in the pre-show, so to speak. And it's something that I really didn't hit on much on my blog this week, but the WikiLeaks issue. I had an opportunity on Friday. Regular readers know that I've had a chance to be on BBC's World Have You Say in the past, and they called me up again to talk on WikiLeaks, but my schedule was such that I just couldn't do it. But I had a chance to talk to their producer during my lunch break. And the question that they were talking about was the WikiLeaks people, did they have blood on their hands? And I very much find it intriguing that there are people who still don't get it, that they live in the rarefied atmosphere of academia and they don't realize the huge amount of damage that in a time of war any document is released can cause. And it's just, it's something in this internet age that it's going to happen again. My only hope is that our Attorney General and Department of Justice will use every tool that they have to pursue every American involved in this and just come down with the hammer of God on these people. Because the only way you're going to stop this is fear. And the only way you generate fear is having a few heads on pikes. Eagle One, what do you think?
Well, as long as there are people who are willing to believe the worst about U.S. policy, U.S. military actions, and don't understand, appreciate the fog of war and the problems that causes for people in the field, you're going to have a willing audience for the leaks like those that have gone to WikiLeaks. And you're right, the only way to stop it is to come down hard on those people making the leak. Now, I understand that they've got the guy, the lowest level guy involved in this, and hopefully they're going to be able to wrap up the rest of the food chain.
And I think we just lost Eagle One again. Hey, there's nobody to disagree with me. He's been having some trouble with his connection from his Fortress of Solitude. So I'm just going to go pick up a bit from there and talk about some of the things that I'm going to have on my blog this week that I'm going to start off with. And something very interesting came out in message traffic last week. For those that are familiar with the climate surveys that we all had to do in the Navy, they're mostly focused on equal opportunity and things of that manner. But they're generally command climate surveys. And good leaders out there have used them as tools where they get their simio, whoever's running it nowadays. They would get together with the Command Master Chief and say, hey, when would be a good time to do this? And a good leader out there, if they really wanted to get a pulse of it, would do it at a time when the command is stressed, towards the end of a deployment, for instance. That way, he'll get some feedback, and he'll be able to get the wheat from the chaff because his sailors are being stressed, so difficult issues are going to come out. You'll be able to pull out, okay, this guy, he's just griping. There's nothing to that, but hey, we found out over here that there are some issues that we need to address. And you go forward and you work from it. Well, now it's come out from the N09 shop over at the CNO that this is going to be reportable. That anytime you do that type of command, you are going to have to push it up. And it's going to probably be something that's going to cease to be a tool, but something that might be more looked at as a weapon, or battle inputs or other things like that. Is it going to be associated? Unfortunate. Eagle One, are you back?
I'm back. I've lost my computer screen. My battery is screaming at me and all that kind of good stuff.
Hey, well, we have another caller on the line. I'm going to go ahead and bring him up. Area code 360, you're on Midrats. Good afternoon.
Hey, I'm a little confused. This is my first time calling. Anyhow, I lost my audio, but one of the things I wanted to talk about, too, was I was just watching the comment talk about drones and everything else. We haven't, the U.S. Navy, effectively put out drones, and the last time we did was the DASH project. And I don't know if anybody remembers that, but that was a complete 20 years wasted trying to make a little helicopter drone carry two torpedoes over the horizon, and each time they lift it off, they went straight into the drink. And everybody keeps reading. I keep reading the proceedings. I keep reading the Navy Inquirer. Drones are the greatest thing since sliced bread, but we haven't tested them. And I just want to know what everybody thinks about that.
Eagle One, when DASH was out, I was still trying to learn how to take the training wheels off, but you were there. What are your memories of the DASH era, if you have some? Eagle One has lost. We've lost Eagle One again, but I still have you on the line. It's funny when you mention DASH, caller, is I've heard some people praise it and other people give the opinion I have right that you have as well. But when it comes to UASs or UAVs or drones, whatever people want to call them, I think one of the least appreciated facts here is when you look at it from an overall program point of view, they're very expensive in that a lot of these things crash and they break. They're very useful and they're a good tool to have, but I think a little better appreciation needs to be taken on board about how these things function. Make sure that you have a production rate that's going up. When I was in Afghanistan, I had a chance to see one of the Brit Predators, and I'll tell you what, it still had new car smell. And they are useful, but it is one of those things I think we need to be cautious about. That we have our modern version of the Dash that they're out there on the frigates given a try on. And I've heard good things, but I think press releases are what they are. I think one thing that we did do between Dash and here is we lost a lot of time in the Navy getting comfortable with it. You have the broad area maritime surveillance, which would basically be a Navy version of Global Hawk, that we're going to use to do what traditional maritime patrol aircraft used to be. So that'll be interesting as well. Caller, do you have some thoughts about BAMs or the larger use of UAVs, or are you just specifically looking at shipboard UAVs?
Oh, well, I'm looking at the whole package because I'm in the Navy right now. I work on the EW side. I work prowlers. I'm out right now with version training, the Growler. And one of my divos came from MPS, and that was one of his. We were sitting around one night BSing in the sandbox, drinking beers and talking about BAMs and UAVs and everything else. He's like, it's all cool and dandy until you turn the EW fight on and everything just flips upside down and goes straight into the drink. But BAMs, I mean, it's a beautiful. If we can make it work, and if we can make it work with organic from Civic or organic from the flagship, it would be awesome. You know, think of all six carrier battles. All we're going to be doing is throw scouts out in the middle of, or even all the battles. You're throwing scouts all over the place, and you're hunting for them, and then you're trying to shoot your main wad at the bad guys before they find you. But, I mean, if you can put three or four Global Hawks up and you launch them from Norfolk, PAX, whatever, as you put a fleet across the pond and they're scouting ahead of you and you're getting that data real time, you know, the only problem then is you're dealing with information overload and you really got to kind of find a way to delegate who's looking at what spot.
I think you brought up a real good point there that's unappreciated. I think drones and everything like that, UAVs, UASs, they're great when you're not dealing with a near-peer competitor. But if you're going to play varsity football as opposed to scrimmage with the JV, there are a lot of assumptions about the electromagnetic spectrum that I think we need to make sure to keep in our planning and our design and our plans to operate in those spectrum. Because the electronic warfare spectrum, without going into anything on an open line, that's a big challenge that we've kind of gotten lazy and spoiled on. What do you think?
That too. One of the last shirts we had before the started taking around is it's cool and dandy. Everybody gets VAQ until you get zapped in the Marshall stack by an SA-5, because nobody appreciates what the voodoo that we do until somebody goes, oh, crikeys, you know, they got all sorts of whiz-bang features. And, I mean, missions that my guys do in Afghanistan and in Iraq, without going to open lines, it's just...
Well, caller, you've really, really broken up, and we're down to about 50 seconds. As a matter of fact, I think we've lost you. But thanks for calling in. I think you ended it on a really good topic that we need to be humble in our technology because we can get spoiled what we are doing here. I want to thank everybody who called in today, and we had a real active chat room today. So for our shy and retiring personalities who didn't want to call in, thank you very much for joining us in the chat room. And what I would like to do is make sure everybody tries to join us next week. We got two great guests. We got Douglas A. McGresser, U.S. Army retired colonel. He's the author of USNI's Press's Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle in 93 Eastling, and also Transformation Under Fire. And we're also going to have Misha Austin. He's a director of Japan Studies and resident scholar in Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you very much, and have a great Navy Day.